Lebanon's caretaker prime minister is warning that his country is a few days away from a social explosion in the wake of a deep economic crisis. Tehran says finalization of the Vienna talks and the revival of the nuclear deal depends on the political will of the other sides of the negotiations. Japan angers China after Japanese deputy prime minister says that Tokyo needs to join the U.S. in defending Taiwan if the island is invaded. This is World News from our Tehran studios. I'm Behrouz Najafi. Welcome. Lebanon's caretaker prime minister has called for the release of international financial aid, warning that his country is just days from a social explosion. Meeting foreign envoys, Hassan Diab said that the international community must help save the Lebanese from death and prevent the country from its demise. He said that the Lebanese are on the verge of a catastrophe, and withholding funds for not having a government in the country threatens lives. People are grappling with a spiraling devaluation and painful shortages. The country has plunged deeper into what the World Bank is calling one of the world's worst economic crises since the 1850s. The international community has pledged aid, but on condition of formation of a new government. Lebanon has been without a formal government since the deadly Beirut explosion last August. Mariam Saleh says the sanctions imposed by the U.S. and some Arab states should be blamed for the worsening economic crisis in Lebanon.
It's really hard to really put the finger on the on where exactly the problem lies, because there are so many accumulated issues. This economic crisis is not just the result of the latest, lack of government formation, the fact that we have protests, the fact that we have corruption which is entrenched in the country. There's so many other issues that play out here. I think that was an issue that was very much clearly expressed by Prime Minister, Mr. Hassan Diab, and also yesterday we heard from Hezbollah Secretary General Said Hassan Nasrallah saying that what the Lebanese are going through is a slow death. And he did not say the same that he does not have anything to do with that, though, of course. They are saying that they want to try to solve the small issues as much as possible by giving social assistance, by bringing in fuel from countries, from friendly nations. But at the same time, there is a major issue, which is the fact that we have U.S. sanctions that continue. And it's not just U.S. sanctions. It's also a certain political sanctions that we have from some Arab states, Arab regimes, like the Saudi Kingdom.
Lebanon's Hezbollah leader, Said Hassan Nasrallah, has described resistance media as partners in all the victories achieved against the oppressors. He also praised the media for breaking the U.S. hegemony in the region. Mariam Saleh has more.
During a conference held by media outlets and attended by media, political, and academic figures, Lebanon's Hezbollah Secretary General Said Hassan Nasrallah lauded the work of the press, especially in its coverage of the last round of fighting in Al-Quds battle. Said Nasrallah began by stressing that the media is a partner in all victories and needs to focus on where the confrontation lies and with whom.
We cannot liberate Palestine without breaking the U.S. hegemony in our region. This hegemony provides the Zionist regime with all required means for its survival. Only 12 days into the Al-Quds battle, the Zionist regime called for aid from the U.S. Therefore, in our discourse, we cannot exclude the U.S. role in the region.
Said Nasrallah highlighted the points of strength of the resistance media, which he says the rival media lacks: honesty, integrity, and the mere fact of backing a righteous cause and facing injustice makes the media of the resistance more reliable, according to the leader of the resistance. The broadcast networks at the conference agreed that there is much work to be done. Some experts at the conference believed the media should develop to the extent that it becomes makers of news and writers of the discourse.
Reviewing the literature accumulated since the world wars and the modern-day conflicts, we always see a discourse in the making. Resistance media have raised the standards of news writing. Today, our media are not just the transmitters of the news.
Experts at law also spoke at the conference, suggesting that there needs to be a focus on the war crimes of the Israeli entity, while focusing on legal terminology.
The crimes that Israel commits against Palestinians, the crimes are really crimes against humanity and all kinds of crime. Israel should really be punished for what is she pursuing and what is she committing against Palestinians and Israel. It's the occupation is illegal by law, by international law, and this is why on the other side it's very legal for the Palestinian to fight for their freedom, to free Palestine, to free Palestine and to free the people of Palestine.
The meetings concluded with an emphasis on highlighting the regional equation of protecting Jerusalem al-Quds from any Israeli aggression. The conference today brings together tens of media outlets which consider themselves in alliance with the resistance forces in the region and speak on their behalf. Sayyid Nasrallah has given his blessings to the men and women in this field while also calling on them to reinvent and strengthen their media discourse. Maryam Saleh, Beirut.
Tehran says the finalization of any agreement to revive the nuclear deal depends on the political will of the other sides involved in the talks over the accord. The foreign ministry spokesman says that all sides to the talks have acknowledged progress in the negotiations, but as Khatibzadeh added, important issues remain that need to be decided by them, especially by the U.S. He said that Tehran's main policy is the removal of the sanctions, stressing that policy will remain unchanged under the new government. Iran and the remaining signatories to the nuclear deal began talks to revive it in April. That was 3 years after the U.S. left the accord. German Foreign Minister Heiko Maas says that a deal to save the accord can be reached in the coming weeks. Political analyst Tim Anderson says that Europe has done little to preserve the 2015 Iran nuclear deal. It has been too weak to stand up to Washington's stubbornness.
The Europeans have done little to try and maintain this agreement. They've been too weak to stand up against the Trump administration when it reneged on the deal. And from the Iranian side, I mean, I know certainly the current administration would like to see an outcome there, and perhaps they're talking positively about it, but I don't think they're going to give in to their position, which is a strong moral position that the U.S. has to show some real dropping of sanctions. And so I don't really think that the Iranian side is going to make any concessions, and I don't think that the Washington side is capable of doing it. But in terms of returning to the 2015 agreement, I just don't think it's going to happen. I think there may be some other accommodation beyond the 2015 deal, but I think returning to that is virtually impossible in these circumstances. However, it might be that the Biden administration is able to start talking to Iran on a different basis and perhaps remove some of the sanctions there. Remember, there are a number of sanctions that the U.S. They shouldn't be called sanctions. They're unilateral coercive measures. They're illegal, basically. But I think that the Biden administration might try and soften some of those as some sort of concession to keep a dialogue of goodwill going with Tehran. But I don't look for much more than that.
Several Palestinian families in the Gaza Strip have been forced to set up tents on the rubble of their homes ruined by Israeli airstrikes during the latest escalation against the impoverished enclave. Rubai Shabat has more.
The latest Israeli airstrike over the Gaza Strip has left several families homeless. In northern parts of the enclave, tents have replaced high-rise buildings leveled by Israeli airstrike. Abu Muhammad, a father of 11 children, has his three-story building bombed. He is now living with his family in his damaged home with nowhere to go.
They bombed our house with no prior notice. We had to escape the streets, leaving all of our belongings in the house. People helped us and offered shelter in armed wire schools. When the war was over, some people went back to their homes, but I felt miserable because I had nowhere to go. We have no way but to live in the tents.
Ala, a Gazan student, has all her belongings damaged when the Israeli regime bombed their home. She is now not able to pursue her studies due to the chaos she is caught in.
We thought we were secured in our home, but they hit us. When I got back here to see what happened to the home, I found my belongings all damaged. My laptop, books, and clothes are all ruined. Now I'm not able to continue my studying. I just want to live peacefully and concentrate on making a better future, and this can never happen while Israeli regime keeps bombing us.
The Gaza Housing Ministry says 1,800 housing units have been totally destroyed and 17,000 partially damaged in the Gaza Strip. Palestinians are still recovering the 2014 war in Gaza that caused huge destruction, and the latest onslaught increased the tragedy. Umm Muhammad visits the building that housed her family for more than 10 years, crumpled down by Israeli airstrikes.
When I first saw my home destroyed, I could not stand up on my feet anymore. Nothing is left safe. We were preparing new units for our sons Mohammed and Ahmed to maintain their life, and now, after 10 years of hard work and saving to redesign this home, everything is destroyed.
The scene of displaced families have turned into a familiar scene in Gaza, as most of Gazans have lost their homes in Israeli airstrikes. Many of them are now camping on the rubble of their homes with nowhere else to go. Ruba Shavit, Gaza.
President of the International Committee of the Red Cross, Peter Maurer, has made a visit to Yemen to closely monitor the humanitarian situation there. He says that Yemenis need international intervention to overcome the current humanitarian problems that they are facing in their lives. Our correspondent in Sana'a has a report.
As part of his tasks, President of the International Committee of the Red Cross, Peter Maurer, visited Yemen and toured some of the most affected areas to check out the humanitarian situation in the war-torn country. He has also held a press conference in Yemen's capital, Sana'a. Maurer said most Yemenis depend on humanitarian aid and the healthcare system is heavily affected by the ongoing war.
80% today of the Yemeni population are considered dependent on humanitarian aid in one way or another. We look at the depletion, at the destruction of health facilities in Yemen, at probably half of the facility compared to pre-war time.
He also said millions of internally displaced are in need of urgent permanent support.
We see that the most vulnerable, those internally displaced, the women, the children, are in millions who need support, who need assistance.
The humanitarian situation in Yemen is catastrophic due to the continued war and siege imposed by Saudi Arabia. The United Nations describes the situation of the war-torn country as the world's worst humanitarian crisis. International aid organizations and watchdogs have repeatedly warned that the lives of millions of Yemenis, including children, are in danger due to the all-out Saudi blockade imposed on the country. However, the international community has so far failed to lift the siege from Yemen. Abdul Latif Al-Washali, Sana'a.
China has slammed Japan for its recent comment that Tokyo may defend Taiwan in case of an invasion. Beijing says it won't allow any country to interfere in Taiwanese affairs.
These kinds of comments are extremely misguided. They are also dangerous. They seriously breach the principles of the China-Japan four-point consensus and harm the political foundation of China-Japan relations. China is seriously dissatisfied and resolutely opposed to them.
Zhao also warned other countries not to underestimate the Chinese people's firm determination, will, and strength to safeguard their sovereignty. He was reacting to a comment by Japanese Deputy Prime Minister Taro Aso, who said that his country might join the U.S. in case of a Chinese military action against Taiwan. Aso, however, backed down from his stance later, saying that any contingency over Taiwan should be resolved through dialogue. China considers Taiwan its own territory under One China policy. It's repeatedly warned the U.S. and its allies against any interference in the island's affairs. Ethiopia has slammed the Arab League for its quote unwelcome meddling in a lingering dispute with Egypt and Sudan over a mega dam on a tributary of the Nile River. In a letter to the UN Security Council, the Ethiopian foreign minister said that the Arab League is known for its unconditional support for Egypt on the issue of the Nile. Demeke McKinnon warned that such an approach risks undermining the relations between the African Union and the Arab League. Tensions escalated after Egypt slammed Ethiopia's renewed filling of the Grand Renaissance Dam situated on the Blue Nile. The dam has sparked an almost decade-long diplomatic standoff between Addis Ababa and downstream nations, Egypt and Sudan. Ethiopia is saying the project is crucial to its development, but Cairo and Khartoum fear it could restrict their citizens' access to water. Russia has recorded a record of 737 COVID-19-related deaths in the past day, and that's the first time the number of daily coronavirus fatalities has crossed the 700 mark, which pushes the national death toll in Russia to 139,000. The country has set six new pandemic highs for fatalities in the past 8 days. It's battling a new surge in COVID cases. Authorities blame the surge on the highly transmissible Delta variant that was first detected in India. A lag in vaccination drive has also worsened the situation. Meantime, in Iran, the number of COVID deaths has surpassed 85,000. The health ministry reported 146 more fatalities in the past day. Over 16,000 more people also contracted the virus in the same period, and this is amid a spike in infections due to the Delta variant. And that takes the total number of cases to nearly 3.3 million. Infections and deaths have also been on the rise since the Delta variant emerged in some of the southern provinces 2 weeks ago. Officials say the variant has been detected in central provinces, including Tehran, too. That urges citizens to abide by health guidelines. That's a wrap for this news bulletin. Goodbye.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
The limelight. The new UK Health and Social Care Secretary, Sajid Javid, has said the best way to protect the nation's health was by lifting the main COVID-19 restrictions. He said rules that we have had to put in place have caused a shocking rise in domestic violence and a terrible impact on so many people's mental health. We're prepared for an article written by Linda Geeds. The piece is titled, UK Scientists Caution That Lifting of COVID Rules is Like Building Variant Factories. The article has been published by the British newspaper The Guardian. Please stay with us for more. UK scientists have warned that the lifting of all COVID-19 restrictions is like building new variant factories at a very fast rate, and said the attitude of the new Health and Social Care Secretary Sajid Javid is frightening. Writing in the Mail on Sunday, on 4th of July, Sajid Javid said the best way to protect the nation's health was lifting the main COVID-19 restrictions. He said rules that we have had to put in place have caused a shocking rise in domestic violence and a terrible impact on so many people's mental health. Reacting to the comments, Professor Stephen Riker of the University of St Andrews in Scotland, a member of the SAGE subcommittee advising on behavioural science, tweeted, "It is frightening to have a health secretary who still thinks COVID is flu, who is unconcerned at levels of infection, who doesn't realize that those who do best for health also do best for the economy, who wants to ditch all protections while only half of us are vaccinated. Professor Stephen Riker said, above all, it's frightening to have a health secretary who wants to make all protections a matter of personal choice, when the key message of the pandemic is, this isn't an I thing, it's a we thing. In the coming days, the cabinet is expected to sign off on the easing of various COVID restrictions in England, including allowing fully vaccinated adults to travel to Amber-list countries without having to self-isolate when they return home, making wearing of face masks voluntary, apart from in hospitals and other healthcare settings, and no longer requiring fully vaccinated adults to take a COVID-19 test or self-isolate if they've come into contact with an infected person. The school bubble system that has forced hundreds of thousands of pupils to self-isolate at home if someone in their bubble tests positive is also expected to be dropped, while pub and restaurant customers may no longer have to scan an NHS QR code upon their arrival. Health Secretary Sajid Javid said, "We need to be clear that cases are going to rise significantly. I know many people will be cautious about the easing of restrictions. That's completely understandable. But no date we choose will ever come without risk, so we have to take a broad and balanced view." He added, "We are going to have to learn to accept the existence of COVID and find ways to cope with it, just as we already do with the flu." Professor Susan Michie, a director of the Centre for Behavioural Change at University College London and another member of SAGE's Behavioural Science Subcommittee, tweeted, "Allowing community transmission to surge is like building new variant factories at a very fast rate." Writing in a blog for the British Medical Journal last week, Professor Susan Michie, together with Professor Riker and Professor Anne Phoenix at University College London's Institute of Education, said Health Secretary Sajid Javid's singular emphasis on responsibility of individuals to identify and mitigate against COVID-19 risks took the emphasis away from what the government must also do. They said, "If people are to act responsibly, they need their government to fulfill its own responsibilities to make safe behavior possible." The fear is that when government talks about a freedom day, when all restrictions are lifted, it doesn't mean that the virus has gone away, and it doesn't mean that the measures are not needed to prevent a resurgence. They noted, "What it does mean is that the government is planning to withdraw all forms of support and abandon us to deal with the pandemic on our own." However, other scientists have said the relaxation of many of the restrictions, while not risk-free, actually made sense. Paul Hunter, a professor of medicine at the University of East Anglia, said, "Double-vaccinated people are less likely to get an infection, and even if infected, are less likely to infect others." Similarly, he said, the additional risk posed by relaxing mask-wearing was unlikely to be great, although it made sense for vulnerable groups to wear face masks in crowded indoor environments, and for those visiting very vulnerable individuals indoors, at least whilst community rates remained high. Professor Paul Hunter said, "The school bubble system may have had some value, but if we accept that we're all going to get repeated SARS-CoV-2 infections throughout life, and we are unlikely to vaccinate children under the age of 11 and may not vaccinate children from 11 to 16, then all this can be said to be doing is delaying the inevitable. This is causing considerable disruption for relatively little benefit." He added, "Even relying on daily testing of asymptomatic individuals is open to debate." Professor Paul Hunter noted, "Of course, We have seen new issues appear during the course of this epidemic, and so no one can be certain of the challenges over coming months. But we will eventually come into an equilibrium with this virus, as we have with all other endemic respiratory infections. Professor Alison Pollock, a clinical professor of public health at Newcastle University, claimed Health Secretary Jarvis' approach was sensible. She said, "Population immunity is rapidly being achieved due to a combination of naturally acquired immunity through infection and vaccination. Unknowns are duration of immunity, impact of variants, and who is at individual risk of reinfection or transmission." Professor Alison Pollock said, "Good infection and outbreak control measures are still important at local level. However, mass testing and daily testing should be stopped, as testing of asymptomatic people is causing unnecessary harm with no evidence that it contributes to reducing transmission." Meanwhile, according to a report, more than one in four young people are worried that poor mental health will affect their ability to find work after the COVID-19 pandemic. After the opening up of the British economy this spring, the Resolution Foundation said young workers were still suffering a heavier toll than their older colleagues and were paying a heavier price with their mental health. It said that 18 to 24-year-olds were 2.5 times more likely at the end of May to be out of work or still on furlough than any other age group, even after the reopening of hospitality venues across the United Kingdom as activity returns to Britain's high streets. It comes amid mounting concerns over the lasting impact of the crisis for young people after 15 months of unprecedented disruption to their education and the start of their working lives. With separate research published recently by the Institute for Fiscal Studies warning that those getting on the career ladder for the first time could bear the scars of the COVID recession for years to come. Despite the opening up of the economy this spring, the Resolution Foundation said more than one in five adults aged between 18 and 24 reported struggles with mental health last month. In a survey of more than 8,000 adults undertaken by YouGov on behalf of the think tank and the Health Foundation charity, fewer than half, or 48%, said their mental health was good. This compared with a much higher rate of 64% for 55-year-olds to 64-year-olds. More than one in four, or 27%, of 18 to 24-year-olds said they were worried about finding a job in the coming months because of their mental health situation, compared with about one in five people aged between 35 and 54, and only one in 10 aged between 55 and 64. Rukmin Sehmi, a senior research and policy analyst at the Resolution Foundation, said young people have been hit hardest by the COVID-19 economic crisis, which has taken its toll on their mental health. Rukmin Sehmi said, "Worryingly, some young people are struggling even while the economy is recovering, and they are fearful about their career prospects. These fears must not be underestimated." The evidence comes as the Institute for Fiscal Studies said young adults were battling greater challenges in the world of work than their older peers as pandemic restrictions are relaxed. The influential think tank said there were growing risks that young workers would bear the scars of the COVID-19 recession for years to come. It said young adults had avoided sliding into poverty during the crisis because of the government's furlough scheme, and as they chose to delay the start of their careers by staying at home, living with their parents while the pandemic continues. Official figures show that under-25s have accounted for two-thirds of the decline in employment in the United Kingdom during the coronavirus pandemic and are more likely to be placed on furlough than older staff.
first methodology that the Quran uses is to talk to the emotional side of the human being.
يا أيها الذين آمنوا, O you who believe, استعينوا بالصبر والصلاة.
And we have set forth for mankind in this Quran full of examples.
Minbar, a lecture on Islamic issues.
Islam is a way of life, a complete way. It's a complete way.
Dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, now let's listen to Brother Hasnain Rajab Ali.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Ya ayyuhal insan, innaka kadihun ila rabbika kadhan famulaki. This is the most fundamental rule, O mankind. Struggle upon struggle till you meet your Lord. People may ask, why struggle? What's the reason for struggle? And many a times we look at, well, you know, people went into depression, they went into this sense of learned helplessness because of the negatives that were faced with, the despair, you know, there was some kind of resistance that took place, it was very difficult to overcome, as a result they fell into the ditch, right? And many times we argue, we wish there were no ditches, we wish there were no resistance, we wish there was no hindrance, we wish there were no problems in life. But we must bear the fact that when we really evaluate the real nature of who we are and what we are created for, resistance and hindrance and problems are an integral part of that growth. It's impossible to grow without them. You know, the best example I use in a very simplistic way is a person who does bodybuilding, right? When they go into the gym, you will see that the more resistance they get, the stronger they're going to become and the bigger they're going to form, because you're now going to tear your muscles. Just think about it. You're going to scar your muscles, right? And when you tear your muscles, when the muscles heal, it gets larger. So you think, you know, the whole notion of tearing your muscle tissue, I mean, that's negative. No, if it's done in a very subtle way where it can handle itself without degrading the quality of the muscle, then you become stronger. So when we have problems in life, and when we have resistance, and we get good, you know, bad news, somebody just denied me what I wanted, you know, the person I love doesn't love me, the wealth that I wanted, or the job that I wanted, or that investment that I put money in no longer produced the results I thought, oh, it's the end of the world, God doesn't love me anymore, you know, I'm gonna quit. And these are all the problems. Look, you are a psychotherapist, Sister Barak, you know, what is the reason, right? Many a times somebody will tell you, something happened in my past. When you study human, you know, development, the 0 to 7 years of age is the most crucial part of a child's growth period, 0 to 7, because they're essentially sponges. They don't have any comments. They don't have anything to give. They are pure takers. And what's given to them becomes the foundation of what they will start to give tomorrow. I want us to understand this. This is crucial. If we abuse a child at a young age, that means we gave them something negative to feel. And if it's large enough, it may become a bigger part of their root system. And that will also start to give off fruits tomorrow with it. So it's very important for you and I to be cognizant that we're causing these kinds of future events. And if we don't show true love and try our best to sort of alleviate, but there is a fine line. And here's the question, here's the point I want to make. It's very, very crucial for you and I to understand this. You and I cannot insulate the growth of a child on a constant basis where everything is positive and there should be no negative. That thought is just, that's an unfair system. When we have sadr, you know, sadr is one of the expressions of the heart. You know, the heart has many names. You have fu'ad, you have sharaf, you have sadr. These are all components of this qalb. Qalb is the generic statement in the Quran. Each part of it has capabilities. And our scholars say from the Quran, sadr is where happiness and sadness, constriction and pain comes, is sadr. When Allah says, Alam nashrah laka sadrak, when Allah says to the Prophet, did we not expand for you your heart? Here, sadr. Why? So that there should be that level of relief for the Prophet from the constriction of pain. Alam nashrah laka sadrak. ووضعنا أنك وزرك الذي أنقذ ظهرك. It was a burden on you. It was heavy on you. It was painful. We expanded it. When Musa عليه السلام is going to Fir'aun, when Allah says, you know, اذهب إلى فرعون to Musa, إنه طغى. Musa عليه السلام knew who Fir'aun was because he grew up in his house. He knew how vicious this man was. He knew how wicked he is. And he knew this is a daunting task. This is not easy. This mission that God is sending me on is a daunting. It's an arduous task. It's very tough. It's like go and lift this 1,000 pounds, you know, it's like, and more than that. Actually, that expression is nothing compared to what Musa had to face. So what does he do? He asks Allah, Rabbi shrah li sadri wa yassir li amri. Wa yassir li amri. But what is the, wa yassir li amri comes with what? Rabbi shrah li sadri. Okay, expand for me my heart, my chest. So that, and the chest, by the way, is not this. These are all components of the heart that cause things. When I smile, it's something in the heart that triggered this. And there's a reaction to my chest, to my expressions, to my ecstatic behavior. It all originates from the trigger of the heart. So Musa alayhi salam says, Rabbi shrah li sadri wa yassir li amri. Make my affair easy. وَحْلُلْ أُقْدَةً مِنْ لِسَانِي. Loosen my tongue. يَفْقَوْ قَوْلِي. So that they understand me. So he understands me. You find that that pressure is essential to do the work of God. When we raise children, we must train them to also constrict the heart. The sadr should be constricted while it's expanded. You know, Sister Sabira here is a pedagogue. She's a teacher. So she will understand this, and especially when you teach elementary. I know, I think you teach higher age groups, but elementary, children, when you teach them, you find these children have to be trained to expand and contract the sadr. Then they will know how to manage the problems of tomorrow. You know what's an interesting observation? Is that you will find children raised in very wealthy communities, very wealthy families, will be put in special schools, in private schools with private teachers, and they will be given, you know, carte blanche in their education. All the fancy tools. I know because we run Wise Academy, so we know the, you know, how we deal with this, right? What's interesting is that, and you will find that if the child, something is missing, Habibi, no, give it to this child. Let them not cry, please. Habibi, don't make my child cry, please. Now, the parent should feel that, right? Because you don't want to scar this child. But we over-insulate the child. We don't let them constrict. We just keep expanding their sabr. Make them happy, 24/7. Anything they want, Habibi, you want. And then the child starts to demand. And once this child starts to demand, on the fly, we supply, you know, because my child has to be good. But if you find the same child, same age range, raised in a lower income community, you will see that that child is not given the kind of carte blanche that the rich kid is given. And they struggle, they get abused in some ways, but in a reasonable way, where they're no longer that prince walking in the school, you know, you're just an ordinary kid. But they learn to contract and expand and contract and expand. Do you ever notice when these two groups become teenagers and adults, you'll find that the maturity of the lower income child is greater than the one who's wealthy. Observe. Their ability to manage problems is easier for the lower income because they have been trained to constrict and expand and constrict and expand. Sometimes, of course, unfairly, which leads them to have problems in the future. But that has to be discussed because these are critical points that I'm just bringing out. Secondly, how do you manage to maintain in the trajectory of never losing hope when a boulder shows up in front of you or when a mountain shows up in front of you? How do you continue with it? Well, I'll give you an analogy. Imagine you're walking and a tree falls in front of you. This is an analogy. There are two groups of people. One will stand there and curse the tree and curse God for having created a tree and curse the tree having fallen. And now they will keep staring at the tree, sit there, they'll actually build a campfire, and they will damn and condemn till they die. Why did that tree fall in front of me? Astaghfirullah. If you look at the human behavior sometimes, people are stuck on something that happened 20 years ago. Somebody said something, I just can't get over it. It's like we use this example, hold a bottle with a little water and you can hold it. But if you keep holding it for a month, a year, this starts to get very heavy. Right? Initially it's very light, but then it starts to get, that heaviness is us holding grudges of the past, the hindrances and the failures of our past. We can't let go. So we sit around that tree and we're condemning it. But the one who is going to progress is the one who says, huh, how do I cut this tree so I can move? Or can I go around it? And you find they go around it. What made them go around it or cut the tree? What lies beyond the tree was so vivid in their mind that they would never let the tree stop them. But if you and I are happy-go-lucky day by day with no thought of tomorrow, then when that tree falls, you and I will be very disappointed.
You're listening to Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran. This program entitled Minbar. Our email address is englishradio@irib.ir.
Rahi Karimun Azim Alimun Halim Hakimun Mateen.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
Despite Biden's rhetoric, American national interests are allied with those of authoritarian crown prince in Riyadh, says Manavi al-Rashid, author in an article titled Saudi Arabia, Why Biden Will Leave Mohammed bin Salman in Charge. Stay tuned for the details of this article, please. Many hoped that Biden would exert pressure on the U.S. most loyal Arab dictators to reverse the tide and respond to calls for democracy and ensure freedom of speech. But in Riyadh, among other places, such unrealistic wishful thinking is beginning to be dashed. Realpolitik is settling in to the demise of Washington's reputation and its endless rhetoric about promoting democracy. American myths about the country's own historical position as the leader of the free world, promoter of democratic values, and protector of individual rights are always exposed in the Arab world at the hands of none other than its most loyal man in Riyadh. Indeed, Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman continues his campaign of detentions, executions, and surveillance. Unchecked by Washington, Biden slightly embarrassed the Crown Prince when his intelligence services published a four-page report that held the Saudi ruler responsible for the murder of journalist Jamal Khashoggi and placed several suspects on a list of sanctioned operatives. The Crown Prince himself was untouched by these superficial measures. Today, Biden and his advisors remain silent on the future of Saudi Crown Prince, but American media and think tanks have been promoting his nemesis, former Crown Prince Mohammed bin Nayef, who has been placed under house arrest and allegedly subjected to bad treatment. Ex-CIA officials want their partner in the war on terror back in the driving seat in Riyadh. How can Washington ignore its loyal prince, who allegedly helped saved the lives of Americans as he shared intelligence with U.S. security services, they ask. In this view, it's an American betrayal of Mohammed bin Nayef, who provided valuable information that helped to foil attacks on U.S. soil. Once the darling of the CIA, Mohammed bin Nayef is now helpless without the U.S. pushing for his release, let alone his rehabilitation as its man in Riyadh. This sounds like a familiar story. Use the man in Riyadh, then dump him when he faces his fate at the hands of his kinsmen. In fact, Biden should resist calls to bring back the deposed prince, who never stopped using violence against peaceful activists and put them on trial in the terrorism courts that he established. Mohammed bin Nayef used the pretext of the war on terror to spread fear and torture. His most famous victims included founders of the Saudi Civil and Political Rights Association, activists such as Abdullah al-Hamid, who died in prison, and Suleiman al-Rashidi. Activist Walid Abu al-Khair remains in prison alongside many others. Many of men and women Mohammed bin Nayef put in prison have been subjected to solitary confinement. Perhaps the arrest of the former Crown Prince by the current Crown Prince fulfilled the hopes of those who suffered at his hands for years, but unfortunately they had no power to arrest him, put him on trial, or seek justice. In his own way, Mohammed bin Salman is punishing the deposed prince, but for different reasons. When the mafia fights its own battles within its own rank and file, the weakened society may achieve some perverse revenge that is monetary and emotional. Both Mohammed bin Nayef and his empowered cousin, the Crown Prince, need to be put on trial for crimes against their own citizens. U.S. intelligence services obviously want the devil they know, but many Saudis want justice for their lost sons and tortured relatives who either linger in prison or have already been executed. Many of their corpses have yet to be returned to their relatives for proper burial. Many of Mohammed bin Nayef's old cronies and right-hand men are not only free, but have the gall to protest. Among them, Saad al-Jabri, who escaped to Canada and is now facing a court case for allegedly stealing billions of dollars when he was in charge of purchasing anti-terrorism and surveillance technology. The court case may shed new light on how the OPEC and corrupt Interior Ministry conducted its affairs and plundered billions under the pretext of fighting terrorism. The day will come when the prosecutor, Mohammed bin Salman, will himself face a similar fate for his crimes against activists and dissidents. For now, the Biden administration remains silent on the Crown Prince's present and future. It is unlikely that Biden will encourage his removal from office or openly challenge his abuse of human rights domestically. But when it comes to political reforms, a muted U.S. is neither willing nor able to see the merits of promoting a process that will eventually lead a kingdom on a path to democracy. At the moment, U.S. national interests are allied with those of an authoritarian crown prince, so why rock the boat? You have just listened to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The Voice of Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1920 to 2020 UTC on the following frequencies. 31 meters, 9,855 kilohertz for Europe, and 31 meters, 9,835 kilohertz for Southern Africa, and FM 91.5 megahertz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or BAT 5, and via internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program, P.O. Box 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
Televised speech on the eve of the 13th presidential election, June 16th, 2021. People's duty with regard to the elections, participation in the elections, and what kind of participation. The people's participation makes the Islamic Republic strong in the real sense of the word. Well, those who speak fallaciously about the elections, and you can see that in some of the statements they make in the newspapers and in the internet, with recourse to various false statements when talking about the elections to discourage people from participating in the elections, they truly strive to weaken the system. The foreign enemies who are also opposed to the elections strive to weaken the system. They know that if the people's participation decreases and the country is weakened, they can bring insecurity to the country, expose it to the terrorism, and turn the country into a parade ground for terrorists. These things happen when the country and the people's support of it are weakened. Of course, they do not say this explicitly, but we hear different words about this in their statements, and we can see that they strive to do this. They want the people's participation to be less so that the system will be weakened and so that they can throw the country into disorder to be able to interfere and to turn the country into a parade ground for their mercenaries. One can see this. Subhanallah, alhamdulillah. Another point is that if people's participation decreases, the enemy's pressures will increase in response. This means that these two have a reverse relationship in the true sense of the word. If public support decreases in the country, we will see the enemies applying increasing pressures in response. If we want the enemy's pressures, economic pressures such as the sanctions and the like, to decrease or ease up, the solution is to increase people's participation. And this public support should be shown to the enemy. Another point that is also important is about the candidate who will be elected as president on Friday. If the new president is elected by a significant majority of the votes, he will have firm support, he will be a strong, powerful president, and he can carry out great tasks. Our country, thank God, has many capabilities. There are many facilities and opportunities in our country. Using these opportunities requires sturdy, active, hard-working, untiring, strong people. The president gains this strength, besides the personal side, primarily and mainly from public support. If people's participation reaches a desirable minimal limit, and God willing, the president is elected with a large number of votes, this will give him the strength to use these capacities in the right way. Alhamdulillah, alhamdulillah, all praises to
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio.